Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand of the company Horns of Odin. And before we jump into it, I do have to do the fillers. You know, we have to plug our Patreon. It's the way we keep the lights on. It's how we keep the whole thing running. It's why the podcast is able to keep going. So if you do have a spare moment, please go over to Patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast. It starts from £3 a month, which is roughly 10p a day, pretty much the price of buying me a coffee once a month. And there, I think we have probably the most stacked Patreon there is anywhere. So you get a bonus episode every single episode that we do regardless, which is our Q&A episode. You can submit your questions ahead of time or in live time, as you can watch the shows live as well through Patreon. As well as that, you get extra bonus shows on top of the bonus shows. So you get a story time episode with Jonas Lorentzen once every month. These are a lot of fun. They tend to be lighthearted. We read through one of the sagas or legends, and they're just a good fun and a good time, and a lot of people like these. We also have another brand new show that we do with a creator from the Viking Crafts world, where we get them on. We do a main show episode, but then after that, the patrons get a live access to basically, it's almost like a show and tell of them doing their craft, teaching us how they do it, their inspirations behind it. The last one we did, people really liked. They were a lot of fun. And then we have another episode coming with Claire Moulet. So there's a ton of stuff on there. There's a ton of back catalog you can also check out. It's like I say, it's how we keep going. So if you can just go over to Patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast, then we would really appreciate it. But let's get into today's show. And I think it's been a long time since this guest's been with you. He was one of the early ones, and that is Ruben Terlouw.
Oh, that's great. Yep.
Yeah. Did I get it?
I was guest number 51.
51. Yeah, that feels so long ago. So you're now 201.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, it's been a while. Dan, you and I last saw each other in Manchester, which is about a year ago now.
Is it over a year or under? I thought it was March time, maybe.
No, it was January, I think.
Oh, okay. Oh, so yeah, it's just been...
Yeah, it's just a little over a year.
And then hopefully we're going to see each other this weekend at the Jorvik Viking Festival as well.
In Jorvik, which is 4 years ago for me. We performed there in 2020 with Heilung, what I'm talking about. This is my second time going to Jorvik next week. That's great. Mm-hmm.
Are you going with Kai?
No, I'm going on my own. I'm gonna be spending time with and photographing with my friends from Wolf Hednas and Sveihanas, which are two living history groups from the Vendel periods, something which I'm very interested in. And yeah, so I also do a living history or reenactment, if you want to call it like that. But I'm going to go there just with my camera this time. And then I will travel down to London to visit some museums, which I think we're going to talk about a lot today.
Yeah, here we are.
So I'm going to be spending a little over a week in the UK next week.
Oh, nice. Are you in Holland now?
Yes. Yeah, that's where I live, in the Netherlands. That's correct.
So where did we get that? This is completely off topic. But where did we... Because I feel like we're the only people that call you guys Holland.
Yeah, so Holland is where... is the North Holland and Zuid Holland, the north and southern two provinces on the west of the country. Those two make up Holland. And the rest of the country, including those, is called the Netherlands.
Yes, I don't know. It's just one. I don't know if it's just a UK thing. For whatever reason, it just stuck as Holland. I don't know whether it was from football or what, but...
Yeah, I think it's from football. But I mean, we call the UK, England, Great Britain interchangeably, whether correct or not. So
yeah, we have a ton of different names.
It's quite funny, yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people struggle getting their head around what's what, because I think the UK is everything minus Southern Ireland. So you've got Northern Ireland in there, but then Great Britain is everything minus Northern Ireland, I believe.
Careful, Dan.
It's very weird. I don't know why. It's well, I do know why. It's a ton of just
Yeah.
crazy history. But yeah, do you want to tell us what we're going to talk about? Because this topic
Yeah, maybe
fascinates
I
me.
should introduce myself because it's such a long time ago now. So my name is Ruben Terlouw. I graduated as a Bachelor of Science Archaeologist in 2020 on day one, Corona, much like in a setting that we are in now, because I was the first student to graduate over Zoom.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was day one of lockdown in 2020. I worked in a museum for a long time, about 7 years, just doing quite basic stuff, honestly, though. And I'm a photographer, so I photograph a lot of historical themed things, lots of it in museums, lots of living history and nature. And I'm a part of Heilung, so that's where a lot of people know me from as well. Yeah.
Yeah, you guys, like I said, it's been a while since we last spoke.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you've
You've been to
had quite a
Thailand.
few on.
You, Boba. I mean, you guys have performed in Thailand. You did the video game awards.
Yeah.
It seems like it's been an insane 12 months.
Not only 12, like I was thinking about it today since the last time I was on here. We toured, well, to me, it feels like after Midgardsblot 2022, where you were at as well, we left to the US
Yeah, that's right. Did you leave like the
for,
next day, was it?
yeah, about the next day. Yeah. For me, it was a few days in between, but many of us left the next day already. So we toured there for a long time. Then we returned. Then we did three Europe tours, which the one in Manchester that you were at was the last leg of those three tours. Then we had a little break. So we are in 2023, which I'm what I'm talking about now. Then we went to Australia and Thailand, indeed. Crazy time, wow. And then, yeah, summer was around the corner already by that time, so we did the summer tour. And yeah, we've been to the back to the US just a little while ago, and we did the Game Awards. That was the last thing that we did. Yeah, and
So,
now we are yeah, going to perform at Red Rocks again soon, so in April. There's a lot of stuff coming that I can't talk about, but yeah.
you guys never get any rest.
No, we should though. It is quite tiring at points. Yeah, it's been a crazy ride. Yeah.
I'd
But
love
it's
to
so
talk a
amazing though.
I'd love to touch a little bit on Thailand. So I don't think I've spoken to anyone about that yet, and it seems such a foreign place for Heilung to perform. It seems
Yeah.
very kind of you wouldn't expect there to be a big Heilung following there.
No, and I could go a little into that if you want. Because I was, and many of us were thinking the same thing, but when you think of it, Thailand is a thoroughly religious country. And if any people know what spirituality is or religion, it's probably them. Like whatever you want to call it. I say spirituality because that's what we're going to talk about later. But these people have a very good understanding of you know, what the concept of religion and a multi-god pantheon means. They are the group that we were with, the people that welcomed us. Wow, it was amazing. I'd never seen anything like that, but we got a whole like entrance with these puppeteers on the airfield, and
Oh, wow.
yeah, it was crazy. It was a very, yeah, I'm just gonna call it religious. It was a very religious experience, straight out of the plane. And these people, the group that we are with, I was gonna say, they have a very yeah, they're very interested in the Nordic mythology, but they look at it from their own religious perspective, which I think really helps in understanding Nordic mythology. Because, yeah, like I said, it's a pantheon with a lot of different gods who stand for different things, go by different names, and have their own mythology. And yeah, they had a very good understanding of that. I would even argue better than some people that, like you, that you would find on different Facebook groups. Yeah,
Yeah,
that was amazing.
I guess that they have a perspective from that multi-god lens. Like, it's not, I assume, you know, most people in Europe and Northern America have been brought up probably around, you know, the idea of a single god.
Yeah.
Where I would say most people, probably Christianity, but obviously there are people, whether it's Islam or Judaism, that are also interested in this. So they would give that complete other perspective of just having that kind of multi-god
Yeah.
society.
I think because they are, yeah, brought up from child on with religion, that they naturally feel oh no, I'm not going to say naturally feel connected to Norse mythology or Nordic mythology, but they were very quick to pick it up for sure. Like they told me a bit about how they came to Bookheilung, you know, because that was a question that was prying my mind. Yeah, it was like again, like Thailand is also I'd never been there, so everything was very overwhelming for me, but. Yeah, we visited a few of these places. We joined them in their re religious customs, and yeah, it was very overwhelming but so beautiful. Yeah,
Good. Yeah,
I
look,
even
I
maybe this is something worth sharing. We were being guided around Bangkok, and we visited a few of these sacred sites, and there was a couple two guys dressed up as two gods. I'm sorry, I can't remember what their names was, but they were warrior gods, and they were doing this warrior dance. Oh, I'm gonna show you something. I'll tell for the people who can't see, but you are familiar with the Torslunda dice. Sorry, there's a reflection in there, but from the Vendel period, it shows the horned warrior and the wolf warrior with the spear.
Yes,
It's an image many people that are listening are probably familiar with.
I think most people, as soon as they, if
Yeah,
they Google it,
so
they'll know.
I was watching that dance, and so they were dancing opposite of each other, doing these very extravagant moves, like very masculine warrior moves, right? And there's a detail on the Torslunda image which shows the toes pointing upwards, like the heels and toes are lifted from the ground. They are in a specific position, which is re really see a lot in different martial arts, especially Eastern martial arts. And they were doing that very same thing, and I was looking at that with my mouth and eyes like boom, wide open, because it looked so similar to the Torslunda image that I was just photographing it continuously, and I made a whole post about it on my Instagram, showing these similarities. And I mean, especially when you're talking about Indo-European religion, something that has been heavily discussed here on the podcast, it suddenly doesn't really surprise you how similar some things are. So I said yes, it was very overwhelming, but it was also like a feast of recognition in many ways.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it was absolutely wonderful.
I would love to go to Thailand.
Yeah.
Not only because I love Thai food, to be fair.
Yeah, you're a spicy man.
The food, I think, yeah, the food is incredible. It's a different type of spice as well. Like the Thai food really does hit you when you get it when it's hot.
Yeah, no, that's not for me, man.
It's a different kind of heat.
Yeah.
So yes, let's get on to today's topic, and that is, well, I'll let you introduce it.
Yeah, I will introduce it. So I wrote my thesis on no, let me wind back a little bit. So I graduated as an archaeologist, but already in my studies, I knew I was not going to be the traditional archaeologist, joining the digs and doing the stuff that people are most familiar with when you talk about archaeology. I knew I was going in a direction more like you are, like trying to make the bridge between academia and people who are not in academia, like the general audience, so to speak, right? So I did a lot of stuff with museums and on what we call audience engagement or public outreach is maybe not the best translation, but yeah, to engage the audience and educate them about archaeology. That was really where my heart was at. And I also have a background, a diploma in media and photography and film. So I already did stuff like that on my own, like with my Instagram, but I knew I was going to go that direction with my studies as well. So I wrote my thesis about the use of sound and soundscapes and music in museums, because I
Okay.
already worked in a museum. I was already touring with Heilung during my studies. I even finished my thesis in the tour bus in America.
How did you get anything done on a tour bus?
Yeah, it's like I like to say I'm a bit of the nerd. Like I don't really party. I don't drink. I'm quite boring, you could argue. But yeah, I managed to finish my thesis in the tour bus, and I a large part of my thesis was a big survey. I think actually Matthias also used part of my data. I don't know if he ended up doing it, but I surveyed the audience of Heilung, so I got like 3,500 people filling in my survey that I did, and with all that data, I could motivate stuff that I was writing about in my thesis
Oh, nice.
about the use of sound in museums. So when I it was Corona time, so it was lockdown, the museums were closed, but obviously I'm somebody who visits museums a lot, mostly for photography nowadays. But as I was writing my thesis, I started to look at museums as different things. So I guess where I want to go with this is that to me, a museum is not anymore, not only as an archaeologist, but generally speaking, is not a place where you just look at objects and you stroll along like many people do. But to me, it's a very sacred place because I see things that I'm familiar with, like swords. I'm very like I read about swords and research swords all the time. To me, these are not just objects that I look at behind like a sheet of glass, or whatever. They are still the same objects that were put in the ground with a specific meaning, with a specific agency, if you will, that are now placed in a very weird place. So I'll come back to that, that we call a museum. And so to me, it was very much a way of rediscovering what a museum means, not only to me, but generally speaking, to the audience. And that was obviously what I was writing about at the time, is how to engage the audience in more than just the object behind the glass.
It is such a fascinating topic. As soon as I read it, I was like, oh, I've never thought of it like this. I probably, but then when I really do start to think about it, I have had moments in museums where things have come across as being very overwhelming, and for whatever reason, sometimes maybe even emotional. And you have this
Yeah.
response to something, and certainly when you can appreciate the past and the history behind it, it certainly does have that connection.
Absolutely. And I think I maybe need to take one step back before I go on, because For the people listening as well, maybe even listeners that may find this that are not familiar with with your podcast, is that I will, when I talk about museums in this conversation, I am only I'm only talking about archaeological museums because that is what my where my background is. Of course, there's plenty of people who have very spiritual experiences in art museums as well, but I will not talk about those. I will strictly stick to archaeology right now because that's where my background is. So I think, one second. I've been talking all day, so I need to take a sip of water or something.
Okay.
Maybe we can go back to what a museum actually is, first of all, because already before Christ, there were buildings that were designed to show objects that were discovered from times before that. I think there's one example in Iran where I sadly forgot the name of, but a museum is not per se a modern invention at all. So there is already like a what's the right word? A question of what was before, even in the Middle Ages. And then when we go on into like the 18th and 19th century, it started to become the institutions that we are familiar with today. Even though at the time, I think they didn't refer to it as museums, but more like maybe you're familiar with the term Wunderkammer. It's a German word, a wonder room is
Okay.
maybe the right translation. But you're probably more familiar with the term Cabinet of Curiosity.
Yeah.
So many people nowadays will probably think of that more in a context with glass jars with fetuses and dead animals and all that.
Yeah, mice,
Yeah, mice.
ducklings is one that I always see as well.
Yeah, they are still the same funny places that they were at the time, but a museum right now is something much different than a cabinet of curiosity like it started out with. I think the museum in Paris, the Louvre, I'm not sure if it's the Louvre actually, but certainly the British Museum, I think, was founded late 18th century, were one of the first really big institutions that were grew out to be the big museums that they are nowadays. And of course there's some controversy surrounding different museums around the world. Like it's become a very political thing today. Even yesterday, just yesterday, there's another incident with soup being thrown at Van Gogh, Claude Monet.
Okay. Yeah, I saw one. I think it was last week thrown at the Mona Lisa.
Yeah, that was the Mona Lisa. But just to illustrate that a museum still, or maybe especially, arguably nowadays, is a place where a lot of emotion takes place, and we're not even talking about spirituality yet. But just to illustrate how important museums are, like they connect people to their not only to their heritage, their local history, but also their political views, maybe their gender nowadays is a hot topic. It is a place of continuous change, and I think that's really, really beautiful because it kind of reflects a way of our society.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, museums are do they are always changing and being added to. The one that I think has always been, or the one that had the biggest impact on me, I would say, is the British Museum. It's a very, well, I mean, the building itself
It's absolutely wonderful.
is stunning. And then when you go into the whole collection, and obviously it does have, there are tons of controversy around all the items in there and how they were gained. And again, that sparks all sorts of emotions in people. But the ability to go and see all these different things from all different walks of life that a lot of the time I probably wouldn't discover. You know, I have my interest in like the Viking Age and Nordic mythology, but you know, I love things from all over the world, whether it's, you know, Africa or Asia, these different pieces that maybe I wouldn't discover unless they were all housed in this one
Yeah,
place.
absolutely.
And you still can have these kind of, I guess, somewhat spiritual reactions to any item that stands out.
But already this, Dan, is very interesting what you're saying, because you are really touching on something very spiritual right here already. And I don't think many people realize this, but I'm not going to name any specific museum because it is already such a hot topic generally, and it's not only limited to one museum, but it's really happening all over the world right now in a time that is already a complete mess. But
Yeah, it feels everything feels like a powder keg, doesn't it, at the moment?
absolutely.
It's just a pressure cooker
Yeah.
of division between people, and it's disappointing because it doesn't seem to be getting much better. It's just things are just getting more and more
Yeah.
fractured.
But where I was going is that you're saying that you like to see these foreign objects, objects that you would normally not see, maybe, because either they are from times that I have long passed, or they are from very foreign places. And a lot of the very big museums over the world, they house objects that are not connected to their soil whatsoever. Yet people get very up in arms about it when the country of origin of this said object wants to reclaim the object as it is part of their own heritage, you know. So we are seeing, let's just take the Western world, because that's where we are from. We're seeing people in the Western world being very upset about, say, an Asian or an African object being removed from a Western museum, because we as Westerners feel connected to this specific object, which is a very spiritual thing. So I think that is really, really fascinating, and I don't think that's something that is what many people think about. Like, they feel connected to something that they find in their museum because it speaks to them in a certain way, and this way might be spiritual or just out of I guess ordinary interest. But certainly there is a way of connection to this object. And right now we are seeing museums contacting one another to, you know, fill in these requests, because this all is very formal stuff. And mind you, we're talking about objects that are have been in this museum for over centuries sometimes. Yet they are being reclaimed, I guess that's the right word, by the country that it's original from. And suddenly it becomes this massive political subject, which I think is fascinating. And it's certainly something that will not be going away anytime soon, as more and more museums are, you know, questioning what they are exhibiting, and what they want to show to the world.
Yeah, that in itself is a fascinating topic that we could probably spend a whole
Yeah, it is. Oh, it
episode
is.
on, because it is just from a purely selfish reason. I love seeing a lot of items, places,
Yeah.
and you know, a lot of them have certainly through British history, that a lot of them have been collected through somewhat nefarious means.
Yeah.
But as a more modern, as well as a modern Brit, I kind of had to ignore the past, and I just love seeing them. But I also very much understand the idea of places saying, "Oh, hang on a minute, that was taken. Can we have it back?"
Yeah.
But my mind always wanders off of to like, well, what? How do you determine where something should go back to? And I guess if you know something was originated somewhere and created there, then you could say, okay, well, this is the origin point, it goes back there. But
Yeah.
what if it's an item that's maybe been taken from somebody else, then to somewhere, and then obviously the British have gone and
Yeah.
taken it from there? So it's had multiple kind of points. So how do they de I always wonder like how they determine the position, because obviously humans have been taken from humans since the beginning of time.
No, I do not know how they do that exactly, because this is stuff that only the upper echelons of museums probably know about. But you are touching upon something that is a very valid question. I guess, when let's take just an example. The British took some objects, say in the 1800s or the 1700s, from point A. They brought it to point B, being a museum, wherever it is. A couple of hundred years pass, and the object has been there for in the museum for this period of time. And then the country of origin, where the object originated from, asks, "Hey, can we get it back?" Then the whole political mumbo jumbo starts. But you should not forget, or you should at least take into account, that the object has also created its own story in the museum itself. So its life at the museum is now part of the whole story of that specific object. It didn't stop when the object was taken from country A to country B, especially since so much time has passed. So I think a museum should take into account, and I think most of them also do, that the time the object has been at the museum, lived its own educational life, so to speak, is also part of this object story. And whether or not it should be returned to the country of origin, that is a whole political theater that I do not know much about, nor do I really want to venture in, because it is a very hot iron. And yeah, I mean, I have my own personal opinion about that, and I think that there are, of course, official ways to go about this as a museum, but it usually involves, or at least time has shown that it usually involves, a lot of politics, and actual modern day politicians want to have their say in this. And this also, this, by the way, doesn't only go for museums. It also goes for a lot of paintings, for example. Like, I'm just gonna take Hieronymus Bosch, because it's a famous painter. One of his most famous painting, The Garden of the Earthly Delights, this triptych that most people are probably familiar with, a Dutch painter. I'm a big fan of Bosch's work. But this specific painting is located in Spain, and we are on good terms with Spain. But I think, I mean, if you would ask our government, they would for sure love to have it for themselves, But and I don't know if they even if this has even been a topic at all. I know it has been returned for one specific exhibition. I think, and I don't even think that the exhibition was in the Netherlands, but in Belgium, where not a lot of other Bosch paintings are exhibited. But I mean, there is something to say for, hey, we would love to have this painting. But then again, it becomes this huge topic. But it also counts, or happens at auctions. A specific painting might turn up, and it goes for sale, and either it disappears in some private collection, because art has been a huge has seen a huge surge in value the last 10, 20 years. It's been going up like crazy, and many rich people use it as an investment, because art, it only goes up in price if you know to find the right pieces. But this is also where many things go lost, and their story ceases to exist. And that is, just to illustrate to how complex everything is, it gets very political, and a lot of money is involved. A lot of people want to have their say, and I think it's pretty fair to say that, the cultural significance of many objects is pretty much on the back burner of the whole discussion. Yeah, it is definitely not the main thing they talk about for sure.
Yeah, I going into private collections is one thing that infuriates me, because
Yeah.
I even if it even if you know a private collector buys them, I feel like they should be almost forced to still put them
Yeah,
in
no,
a
absolutely.
museum so they're on public view so they can be enjoyed by everybody, because it is so disappointing when things just go into private and they're just, yeah, they
Yeah.
disappear.
And not even to speak about all the, that is a whole different topic, by the way. I'm not going to go into that too much, but not to speak about the metal detectorists who find specific objects either illegal or legal or illegal. I would even argue that most of the most spectacular objects in archaeology are probably in private collections that have not ever seen the light of day. Because I've met a few of those people and they showed me their stuff and my eyes fell out of my head, because that is truly world-class museum worthy stuff that is just sitting in somebody's cabinet at home. And
Yeah, it's.
I know, this is the funny, because this ties into the whole discussion about spirituality. They probably feel a very spiritual connection to their objects, because they have taken them out of the ground, as usually us archaeologists do. I like to romanticize a little bit. I even did that more than I was allowed to during my my studies, because I want to see and touch these objects, right? And
Yeah.
they would just take them out of my hands and put them in the bag, because at the end of the day they have to go to the place where we store all that stuff. But to come back to the detectorists, they are the first to touch that object, to take it out of the ground and take it out of context, which is absolutely horrible, of course, because you never know if you or you hardly ever know if you take something out of a bigger context when you find a singular object. But these detectorists, they always talk about how they are almost entitled to be the owner of their finds, and that is absolutely not true, because to me they belong to the people, to us, to the museum maybe.
I think that is a fascinating topic on its own, and I actually I know a metal detectorist who has an incredible collection, who I'd actually, I've just you just got me thinking that I would love to maybe get him on here to speak about,
Yeah.
because I'm pretty sure with his stuff, I mentioned him to him before, he kind of offers them up to museums before, I think.
Yeah,
But
that is,
I'd love to speak to him and get that side, because it's the topic itself is just, I don't know where I sit on it, because on one hand, I'm quite glad that people go out and look for things, because obviously, as you know, the money isn't always there for archaeological digs for everything that should go on. So you kind of find new things through people going out,
yeah.
but also people find things and just keep them because either they know they just want the item because it's really cool and old, or maybe they don't understand the significance behind it. But also, I don't think the avenues are there for museums or governments to maybe reward people in a way that the detectorists would probably be
No.
more willing to give bring the items forward if, say, there was a financial reward. I bet a
No.
lot more would maybe bring them.
There is I can name you an example that's pretty close to my heart and pretty close to your home, actually. The Staffordshire Hoard, which was found in 2009. To the people who don't know, the Staffordshire Hoard is next to Sutton Hoo, which has been mentioned a lot on this podcast. One of the most significant finds of Anglo-Saxon culture is a 7th-century gold hoard, which was found in Staffordshire. And it was found by a detectorist who had permission to walk on the land from the farm. And he found this massive gold hoard, which is now, I think, exhibited in Leeds, but I'm not sure. Sure, I haven't seen it with my own eyes, to my own shame. But
If it's in Leeds, I have even more shame because I'm about 10 minutes from Leeds and I've not
That's
seen
fine.
it. So I'm going to quickly Google this whilst you finish your story so I
Yeah,
can see
okay,
exactly
so
where it is.
I'll continue. This man found this amazing gold hoard, and it spawned an emergency dig by archaeologists who overnight and in total secrecy completely scanned the whole area and took every possible item, sorry, every scanned every possible location, every centimeter of this spot for more, and they found a very, very sizable hoard, which was worth a lot of money, because I think in the LA it is by law that the finder gets a certain amount of money and the owner of the land gets a certain amount of money, and I think they split it in two. It's maybe not the most important detail, but from what I remember, both the owner of the land, the farmer, and the detectorists who found the treasure got into a bit of a fight about who gets what amount of money. And I don't know where, again, if they split it or not, but this is something that the government actually has a say in, because this is by UK law, has to do with the treasury or something like that. I do not know. I could ask next week maybe, because it's quite important. But just to illustrate that again, how complex this whole thing is when when archaeology comes to light, and gets taken out of context, because that is where my whole talk about spirituality actually comes from. You're taking something out of context, and you either exhibit it in a special place like a museum, or it gets taken elsewhere. And I guess that's where my story starts.
Yeah,
So
so I think that the Staffordshire Hoard is in st the Stoke Museum, Stoke-on-Trent.
okay,
But I also saw something about Birmingham Museum, so I'm not sure if it's if which one
Your
it's
one
in.
of your previous guests, my friend Paul Mortimer, who I'll be seeing next week. He knows a lot about this
Oh,
specific
wonderful.
report. Yeah,
Okay.
he knows
Yeah.
all the details. But I mean, in the grander scheme of the story, I think I got across that when somebody finds a treasure in the ground, it is by country determined what happens to this treasure, and there's a lot of illegal digging. They call it night stalkers or night hawks, I think. People who at night go to archaeological sites and take everything out of the ground for either their own or financial profits. It's quite horrible.
Yeah, I don't I think the intent of how the objects got in the ground is important. I feel like I remember this from talking with Martin Carver about Sutton Hoo. I think it depends on if it's maybe say a burial where the items were put to rest and there was no intent to ever go back to them. Then I think that the person who discovers them then or technically owns them or has more rights to them. But if they're put in there as maybe like loot, so they were stolen items that were put in the ground as a way of like to come back and get take later and in the eyes of the government avoid like taxes or for whatever reason. I think then the government can claim ownership of them as a way of basically saying, look, these items are either stolen or shouldn't have been there, taxes should have been paid of them, whatever. We now believe that they're owned by us.
This really depends on what country you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm just talking about the UK.
I know, but maybe before we go on to the next topic, I can quickly summarize how it is here. So metal detecting is legal in my country. However, per municipality, it is determined on where you can, look for items and where you can't. And luckily, in many places, it is prohibited to metal detect. and this is determined by archaeological value. There's a specific value pointed to a specific region. So let's say in Frisia, where there's a lot of early medieval archaeology in the ground and a lot of high profile sites, it is illegal to search with a metal detector there. However, if you know somebody privately, like a farmer, he can grant you access to his land and you can look for items there. However, you cannot dig below 30 centimeters because that is when you enter the legally appointed, is that the right word? Where you enter actual archaeology, where an actual archaeologist or a municipality has to go digging. So you cannot go between these or below these 30 centimeters. And I mean, I can go and look for stuff here, but just across the river from here, it is highly illegal to do that. So yeah, it's very complex stuff. And this really goes into politics and whatever. But it is a very good thing that some countries, like for example Sweden, have prohibited to go and look for metal detecting, very much for the reason that you're taking stuff out of context. And Dan, if you allow me, I'll just bridge into what we're going to talk about from here, because yeah, we were going to talk about spirituality in museums and stuff that is because I can talk about this stuff for ages, but I also want the listener to, you know, yeah, I want to give them something to think about. And when we're taking stuff, archaeology, out of context, and we put them in a museum, to me, that is where my whole thesis, you know, originated from. You are continuing the story, however, in a different place. And I think the museum is. It's such a fascinating place, really. I'm a bit biased, of course. But when you think about a museum, it is very much a place of limbo, actually. And some people who maybe follow my Instagram have seen me writing about this, because I called museums the great halls of the afterlife in a very romanticized way. But I mean it very, very seriously, actually, because yeah, we find stuff in the ground and we examine them. It's all for educational purposes, and you know, we want to know about the history of specific culture, a specific place of a specific country. And you know, yeah, the academic story usually kind of ends when these items are fully documented. Like you could even drop a specific object and it will maybe damage beyond repair. But as long as it's properly documented, the story is still there, right? Because we have all the data. However, and this is where spirituality kind of kicks in. In my book, when you exhibit a specific grave, for example, in its own context, so you have all the objects that are found in this grave context and you exhibit them in a museum, to me, that is still a grave. We have only moved the item from point A to point B. And what something very fascinating happens here, because this is very much a society thing, I think. But you know, most people, sadly, they will look at the object in the museum and you know continue to item B, C, D, and you know, that's their whole day. That's a regular museum visit, even for me. Like I also go from item A to B, but it's like people kind of forget that this object is there in a museum and it's in its display, and you know, they have their little sign. It's like almost like a tweet. It only has like 140 characters, and
And so many people don't even bother
that,
reading them.
yeah, and it's incredible. It's so stupid.
And
Because you know, you cannot tell a whole story in so many characters, right? And of course, nobody will listen to my rambling for 2 hours in the museum. But at least, you know, think about that this object that you're looking at, especially when it's from a grave, and I will come back to that later if you will allow me, because I'm gonna talk for a while here.
No, feel free.
They forget that the object is still in its or at least it should be in its original context. It's still a grave context what you're looking at. But people and obviously the museum works as kind of a filter here because it doesn't look like it's in its original context anymore because it's in a glass display. And you know there's a lot to say about that as well. But people forget, you know, to summarize this, that there is still a very spiritual significance to a certain object when it's in a museum. The story doesn't end there, I guess is what I want to say. Especially when it's about, you know, burials, bog bodies. I'll talk about that later. Yeah, I really want to encourage, and that was why I wrote my thesis to bring this piece of context into the museum, because right now it is very static, and that is also where, you know, the Wunderkammer, the Cabinet of Curiosity, was very much designed to, you know, stack as many foreign objects in one place, because that's, you know, where, you know, people they get amazed by all this different stuff. But as museums grew into, you know, more educational institutions, they tried to get more context in there, luckily. But still, nowadays, when you talk about a museum, many people still think of it as a collection of glass displays with a lot of, you know, old stuff. And where my story comes in is that I want to create this extra context, but more, even more so, I want to bring back spirituality and even more, but I'll get back to that later again, a ritual into museum, because we are very detached from modern day person to object, because there is this barrier that the museum itself has created, arguably that the museum itself is, maybe. Yeah, that was a very long summary, but you know, this is a very abstract concept to talk about, of course, and many people will have a lot of different things to say, and I'll go back in more detail later. But
Yeah, the grave one I think is incredibly interesting because I never know where I sit on this because at the end of the day it's somebody's grave. And just because a certain amount of time has passed, do we or should we have the right to just take this from its resting place and put it in a museum just because we find it interesting? It's almost like, would you in 500 years, would you be comfortable with somebody digging your grandma up and
Yeah.
saying, this is
Well,
interesting, let's put her in a museum?
yeah.
Because that's kind of effectively what it is, and I but
Yeah,
also
depends
I'm like
what it is.
but also I'm like, oh, I'm glad that it is there so I get to look at it and learn and have this experience and see
Yeah.
everything. So it's this very kind of twisted thing of kind of like, I don't know where to sit on this.
No, and that is obviously where this whole thing is about. And I'm glad, Dan, that you know, you facilitate this podcast and have me talk about this, because this is a topic that I really wish more people think about. And you know, the easiest example here is the bog bodies, and I think you've also talked about this on different podcasts. But you know, fascinating subject for people unaware. A bog body is are the remains of a person found in a bog, obviously. And you know, usually we still find complete people, and especially Denmark and the Netherlands, Ireland to so as well. We are, I think, the three countries that have the most bog bodies, for sure. Denmark, most famous for it, but I think the Netherlands has an equal amount, almost. Not all of them are on display, actually, by far. Ireland, the Museum of Dublin, has a very good exhibition on bog bodies. Also, in a way that I'm very happy to see, because they really treat the actual exhibit, the way it is designed, is very respectful. Something that other museums, not only limited to bug bodies, but can certainly learn from. Another, I guess, shout out to Mostcard Museum, who also has an excellent display of the bug bodies there. It's a very quiet room. I would say, in my memory, it was almost perfectly quiet. It's very intimate. It's very in your face. Like, really, props to that museum. I hope to work with them in the future on stuff. It would be amazing. But I guess that's where I wanted to go, is the way that bug bodies are exhibited. And again, to come back to what you're saying, like, should we even do this? Is a very, very important question. Something that I've thought about a lot. And actually, I photographed a lot of these bodies and only published a picture of one of them, because I do not even feel comfortable spiritually to, post this stuff out in the open on this crazy app that is Instagram. To come back to the exhibit of or the exhibiting of bodies in the first place, like, we're all familiar with mummies, Egyptian mummies. And small side note, most of the museums in Europe, they actually started out stealing mummies. Napoleon himself was very much responsible for this Egypt craze in Europe. So that is where most museums nowadays come from. But to come back to the bug bodies, should we exhibit these bodies? Yeah, for educational purposes, it's absolutely important that these things are preserved and that we can learn from them, because they are not only part of our heritage. It's very loaded words. I'm a bit careful, throwing that word around, but for sure it is, part of the identity of Denmark, of the Netherlands, of Ireland, of all these countries, and very important story to tell. However, you should also look into, again, the context of these ritually disposed bodies, because that's what they are. Most of these bodies, they are sacrificial remains. They are remains of people that were sometimes, but definitely not always, sacrificed against their will. And spiritually speaking, I think that is something that a museum should think about. And you can write everything I say off as saying, that's all hippie stuff, we don't go there, we are only there for our educational value, because we are a museum. And they would actually be, that's a very valid point from them. That's certainly a philosophy you can go by if you're comfortable with that. But as a museum, for sure, I think you should think about that. People like myself, and hopefully the people listening to this episode, think of twice, before looking at a body like that, because yes, you are looking at something that holds agency to me. But I'm not going to repeat myself continuously. This is something very subjective, of course. But when you look at a body, you should really think about, you're looking at a person. And in our Western society, it is far from common to actually exhibit a body in the first place. Like, I can only think of Lenin in Russia, the body that is on display there, I think. But I don't know of any other politician or, any modern day body that is on permanent display. Yeah, I know the bodies exhibition that most people might remember from 10 years ago, the traveling exhibition, which had all these, do you know what I'm talking about, Dan?
No, I didn't.
No, I think you do, because it's been like very popular on internet. But
Okay.
it was this exhibition that traveled around where modern day people, deceased people, were cut in slices, so you could look.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that
Yeah,
one.
yeah.
That was the first exhibition actually that I was thinking, like, whoa, I'm pretty fucking uncomfortable looking at this.
Yeah.
Mind my language, but that was very revolutionary. But yeah, the bug bodies, these bodies still hold agency. They are ritually sacrificed, and now I'm really going into the spiritual stuff. I think it is amazing that we can, it's absolutely mind-boggling that we as modern day people can look at this, because think about it from the sacrificed person's perspective. Think from the bog body's perspective. You are being sacrificed, in the late Iron Age, to go for religious purposes, because the tribe A wants this, or tribe B wants, to please this and this god, maybe Woden. So this person is thrown into a bog, and I think at the time, for sure, they didn't know it was going to be preserved for such a long time. But this is where it even gets more interesting, because the body is now exhibited in a museum. So we are literally their afterlife. We took them out of context. We displayed them for our modern eyes to look at. So we are basically the gods taking him out of his sacrificial spot, out of his bog, where he has been laying, basically waiting for his afterlife for thousands of years. And now we are looking at this body with our modern eyes. I think that is absolutely wild. Because we are literally there after. He's back among the living people. Think about it.
It is crazy when you really start to think about and appreciate that these are people, because it's so easy to detach yourself. But I think especially with skeletons, because they don't look human anymore.
No.
I know the one for me, the first time this topic ever really hit me in a way where I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm comfortable with this, was the Repton Man. I went to the site of where the Repton Man was found, and there's no display, there's no plaque,
No.
there's nothing. There's just a school next to it, quite a well-off private school that has no real care for the fact of this historical figure that was found there. There's nothing to even mark that this was a grave, and obviously he's just displayed in a museum. And when I first, when I, you know, when I really thought about it, I had such sorrow of the like this what this is, or well, was a human, still the skeleton of a human who was buried with a lot of intent. He had a clearly had like a lot of ritual items with him, and he was buried in this spot. And we've kind of just dug it up and gone, this is really cool, let's put it in a museum, and then not even taken the care to mark the grave and said, this is where this person was once lied, this is the significance behind it. Almost just like a in my eyes, a complete disrespect by not even marking or commemorating it. And it is, someone is, it is a grave. It's taking somebody from their resting place.
100%. And I do have to comment on this though, because I can take a local example here. The Ede girl is a famous bog body from the Netherlands. She is a very young, she was a very young girl, sacrificed in the bog here in Drenthe province here in the Netherlands. And she was found a bit over a century ago, I think, maybe a century and a half. I should know, but I forgot. And the day she was found by peat diggers, that's the word, peat diggers. They thought they were looking at a recently deceased person.
Oh,
It's
wow.
obviously kind of weird because they were digging in the ground, but you also have to kind of excuse these people, because it's in the zeitgeist of their time. They thought they had dug up a modern body, so to speak, and they were scared, so they let her lie there for overnight. And here's an archaeological detail for the people wondering: a bog body is only preserved because it's so wet, and the acidity of the ground allows these bodies to be preserved for thousands of years. It's because peat is very acidic, and Yeah, it is this one in a million kind of substrates in the ground that allows for human skin to be preserved. But once oxygen, once it's exposed to air, these bodies they literally fall apart right in front of your eyes. And I actually mean quite literally, because within the span of a couple of hours, it will not look human anymore. It will actually look like like a wrinkled rubber, more or less. So
Wow.
most bug bodies are found, almost always human-like, in perfect shape and condition. I mean, we're speaking about 2,000 years here, so as human as you can look after 2,000 years in the ground. But these peat diggers, they let her rest overnight because they were scared. The next day, she didn't look human anymore, and the local people there, they took her teeth and her hair, which was still intact, because it was, you have to think about this cabinet of curiosity mindset here. They wanted to bring that stuff home, right? So a lot of information and data got lost the day she was discovered. However, where I was going is, so she's in a museum right now, and all her remains are being put there in a very respectful way. But yet, you're still looking at a sacrificed girl here. So as a museum, especially when you have kids around, you have to think about, how am I gonna respectfully exhibit this person, because it's still a person, but she's right now in her, what I just called her real afterlife among living people. The question whether or not you should exhibit a body in the first place, I think there is a lot to say for both camps, like the educational camp, yes, we can, and the spiritual camp, like, no, we can't. And I'm right there in the middle, of course. That's what I'm talking about here.
It is, because I don't know where I sit. I love the fact that I can go and see these things. I love that they're preserved, so we can enjoy them and learn about our history. But also, it's like the humanity side of it is like, these are, you're taking them from, well, and in the case you just said with the girl, it's almost like she died twice. And
Yes, she
it's,
did,
she
literally.
was she was preserved in a very good form, and then obviously when she was taken out, she's then decayed and kind of collapsed, and it's just a whole, her journey has changed once again from this resting place and quite, preserved quite well, and then just rotted. And it's like, who gives anybody the right to kind of mess with things like that as well?
Well, you can also look at it from this way, though. And it may sound like an excuse, but if people at the time, like, we're talking about the Iron Age here, but it also goes for Egyptian mummies, I guess. If at the time they were sacrificed for with the intent of an afterlife, then yeah, I mean, f go for it. Exhibit them in a museum, because doesn't that kind of grant us the green light to give her actual final resting place, being at a museum, like with our modern day technology and all that? That is also a way to look at it, but
And I guess particularly the most famous cases, let's say Ötzi, probably the most famous preserved body case. He's taken into immortality, and the same with all these, they're all have a sense of a life after their physical life in the museums, because they're now displayed for people to learn about time and time again. And it is a, like I said, it is a almost, yeah, it probably is like an immortality of just, it carries on. And I think about myself, it's when these people were buried, that most for the most part, that was it. And then they're dug up and thought as very significant to it in a historical context. And their story survives on, and their maybe their name isn't known, But
No.
people know this body for as
Yeah.
long as these museums are going to be there. Now, so if that was me, I'm like, oh, would I rather just be left in a bog, nobody ever knows my name and knows I was even put there? Or would I rather be put in a museum and everybody knows me and I'm quite famous from now on, and I have some legacy to me? And that's I think that's a quite tough question in itself. Do you want to just be forgotten, or do you want to be somewhat famous in?
I guess both is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, throw me in a bog, yeah, for sure. Maybe here's a funny question to everybody listening as well. Like, let's say you're gonna die pretty soon. You're gonna get sacrificed, and let's say the scenario here is that you oh, good point, Bob. Let's say you can take a few items with you. Most people nowadays, their items that they have on most of the time are their phone, their bank card, maybe some jewelry and stuff like that. Like you and I, we're both wearing jewelry because we have a connection to this object. But for sure, nobody is taking their phone in their grave.
No.
But yeah, that's just a little funny thought to think about. Sorry, Bob's message disappeared, but can you please, Daniel, read what he said?
So Bob said, please touch on the ethics of representation.
Oh yeah, wow. Maybe elaborate a bit more on that, yeah. Because that is a pretty broad topic for sure. But yeah, I wanted to touch on this and I will, but it was one of the things that I kind of struggled with a bit because and please, Bob, if you're correct me if I'm not going in the right direction here, but the representation, I think the way that we literally display the bog body. There's a few museums out there, and I touched upon it a little bit already, that they really design a new resting place for these bodies. And this, but again, this doesn't go for bodies alone, but in general, generally speaking. But grave context for sure is and grave archaeology is the easiest way to bridge this topic. But there are also museums out there that display bodies in a fashion that I strongly disagree with. And this it feels so disrespectful for me. But I think maybe it is because literally how the museum is built doesn't allow for elaborate ways of exhibiting these items, these bodies. But in some ways it almost feels like you're walking over the street and the bodies are exhibited in a way like you're window shopping.
Yeah.
It is too much noise, and this is exactly where my thesis was about. So it feels like it has been taken completely out of context, and it's just displayed there for the sake of displaying. And for sure they will have th thought about like how can we respectfully display this, and maybe yes or maybe no, the literal space that they are in didn't allow for it. But either do it respectfully or don't. That's my book. And there obviously you're limited, maybe financially, structurally. There goes a lot into the preservation inside the actual display, like temperature and stuff like that. It's very technical stuff. But these things should not be the main factor in the discussion whether or not are we displaying this ethically or not. And I think there's a lot of museums that can learn from, say, again, the Moesgaard Museum in Denmark, who actually created a silent room where the bog body is very dimly lit, and you can actually sit with the body. And to me, I still get shivers because I sat down there, and yeah, you are very intimately situated with this body right next to you. It almost feels uncomfortable. Like And that is exactly what is amazing about it, because this room forced me into being intimate with this body. It was very, very personal. Like, you know, when sometimes you're walking somewhere, it can be anywhere, and you kind of feel like, I shouldn't be here. Exactly that feeling, but the opposite side I had with that body. I think it felt very intimate and like, okay, I when I entered that room, I actually asked, like, spiritually asked, like, am I allowed to enter this room? And again, this is very subjective, each to their own. And I felt, yeah, I'm welcome here. I can be with this body. That was my own little ritual. And you know, there's a lot of maybe there's other people doing the same thing, and they felt like they weren't allowed to be there. But the room created a very respectful context to the body, so I felt very at ease being there. Yeah, to me, that was a very spiritual experience. In other museums, it was the complete opposite. Like, there's people who didn't want to see the bodies, maybe from a spiritual perspective, maybe because they were just not interested in seeing these bodies, or maybe they, you know, any reason. So they continue their museum visit, and by all means do that. But the literal layout of the museum, you know, wasn't respectful to these bodies. It was exhibited in a way that allowed for a lot of space and noise in the room, and that is the last thing that I would want to see in a museum, because it is very anti-spiritual. It is
I think
very disrespectful.
there's probably so many people that walk past, particularly I think when it's skeletons and you know they don't look human anymore, they just walk past and don't even think twice about the life and you know the history that goes with this being a person and all the feelings and emotions that they had.
And that is fine. If you're like that, fine. I'm not going to force you to be spiritual. That's the last thing that I want and that the museum should want. I mean, each to their own, but at least, you know, create the space for it. That is all what it's about. And that was what my thesis was about too. It was about immersion. We don't have a translation for that in the Netherlands, actually, in Dutch. I think it's a very beautiful word. Like, my thesis was about, in the bog body context, you know, create a sound system that can play sound in a specific way that gets really, you know, like ASMR stuff. Like, I can be very close to the microphone. That creates a literal audible context to respectfully to the respectful to the time where the bog body was sacrificed in. So literally create the context that this very body was in for thousands of years audibly. And visually, of course, you can do a lot of things with that, and I do that with my photography and all that. But I wanted to create the most respectful way to display certain objects, and I presented that in a thesis for, you know, museums to implement if they want that. And many museums nowadays, they have learned that, especially the very youngest generation, you know, Gen Z and all that, they have a very limited attention span, but you can bridge that if you make like a more immersive multimedia thing. And this is also something that I want to talk about. Like, if we're moving away from object in glass display to object in context with, you know, media presentations around it, many museums are moving to there, and Mosgaard again is one of the prime examples here in Denmark, who does that. You actually take away a bit of the load that an object has to carry. So if I create more context around said object that I can still learn from, then, you know, the experience that you have as a person in relation to the object doesn't have to weigh as much, if you get where I'm going.
But do you think that then takes away from the object?
Yeah, it
Because
does.
that kind of bond one-on-one, you know, you said with the bog body it was silence, it was you very connected, and the more kind of stuff that's around, yes, it might make people interact more or their attention span, because that's the way we all are now. We have terrible attention spans, but also that connectiveness disappears.
It does, and that is very much what I also found out is that, of course, there is this, pardon me, very thin line of where to go. Like, where does object weigh? How much does object weigh, and how much does presentation weigh? It's a very, very great balancing act, and that is where museums are, you know. What museums are finding out nowadays that are going that direction, like where's the knowledge gain and when does it just become a thing to look at? But I think there's multiple ways to go about this, and you can still have a very spiritual experience and still very much connect to this object, even if there's sound playing. Like the example that I just gave, the silence spoke volumes. That was beautiful. I think it could also have been the same experience if it were, you know, if it showed like a multimedia presentation of maybe a bog. Like maybe there's projections going on and there's sounds playing. Like again, context here. I think I could have had the same experience then as well, but this also goes into our Western society. Like we mourn in a very silent way, right? Whereas in Viking Age, for example, and the Iron Age, like it was, you know, sacrifice was a huge thing, a lot of sound and chaos and stuff like that. You've talked about that on the podcast, like these great festivities that were described by the Arabic writer from that witnessed the burial, the Kiev and Rus a ritual. Again, it was a very elaborate ritual, a lot of sound and things happening, but we here in the Western society think of, you know, mourning and rituals a very silent thing. So just saying that there's multiple ways to go about to presenting such a thing.
So Bob did clarify, and I think he makes an excellent point. So just to read out what he put, he said we'd have to be really sure. Sorry, someone else typed and I had to scroll back up. He said we'd have to be really sure of who and what a person is when they go on display as
Oh, yeah, I
say
like
the
that.
description, because the
Okay.
narrative of bog bodies being slaves or criminals
Yeah.
puts a certain stamp on them, which may or may not be tied to
Yeah.
ideological history writing than fact.
Yeah, so I kind of misinterpreted Bob's co first comments here, but man, it's a very valid point. I mean, I could go on about that, but I think he put it very well. It's there are so many ways. Again, this is your podcast slogan. It's complicated.
Everything is.
And yeah, bog bodies are also a very extreme example, I think. Like many museums don't even have to deal with that because there is not many of these bodies around, and not many other objects arguably require the same questions. I think and
But
many objects they kind of lose their agency. Like let's take a Christian example. After the Reformation, many of these statues they kind of lost their meaning because, you know, either they were demolished or whatever, and maybe they went to a museum, you know, centuries later. And for sure, you don't have to ask the same questions that we just, you know, described the bog bodies about to something else, to a statue like that.
I think it is a fascinating point that that Bob made there, because we ascribe like historical ideas to everything, whether it's the mummies or the bog bodies or just general probably grave finds. You put an idea that you have in your head, but we don't really know the person.
No.
They could have been a massive cunt.
Yeah.
They could have been, and then
Yeah,
we put
that's
them in
right.
this
Again.
case and almost glorify them as this
Yeah.
figure that is to be awed and kind of
Yeah.
looked
Again.
at admirably. But we don't know them, and they could have just been Horrible.
Again, it's a very valid point. Actually, something that I didn't think about too much, not in that sense. It's very, very good comment. But yeah, I mean, very objectively speaking, you should treat everybody, of course, as a as an equal, I guess. Especially when they have, the weight of a whole culture upon their dead shoulder.
It's wild because I couldn't imagine somebody digging me up in, 1,000, 2,000 years, and then everybody from this time, well, like so many people from this time period that we're in now, all hangs on me and what they on my body and what they find with me, and everybody looks back at that and goes, oh, so they all must have done this, and they
They
all
all
kind
have
of.
tattoos,
Well,
Dan,
yeah,
man.
they all were like the and like just so much wears on these finds. It
But
would be quite.
however though, like, yes, it does, but you should maybe not look at them like that. They represent just as, like, you would represent a very minor thing of British culture, unless you were. We found some remnants of British Yorkshire tea and stuff like that. But
It's in the veins.
it's bro, yeah, with a bit of luck, it is actually. But no, but yeah, again, like, it's these bog bodies, they are a very extreme example. I'm thinking about maybe I could take another example. One of my first post that I did about this subject also was in Corona times. I was in the Historiska in Stockholm, which is, by the way, also such an amazing museum with an amazing Viking exhibition on today. They renewed it. Really wonderful. A lot of multimedia stuff, a sound, projections, very much this immersive experience that I was talking about. However, they have a room called the Gold Room, and it is in the basement of the museum. There's a lot of gold in there. It's amazing. A lot of Vandal period stuff. And what I particularly liked, because my specialty, archaeologically speaking, is in the Vandal period, 7th century Sweden and the Age of Sutton Hoo in England, 7th century stuff. And one of my favorite graves, the one that I'm also reconstructing in my living history project, is situated in that room. And that room has a few shields displayed as well that are found in those graves. And I was thinking, like, to me, it didn't take a lot of fantasy to think that this grave, the stuff that was found in this grave that is there on display, surrounded by these shields, looking around in that room, I got shivers thinking, like, we have actually not on purposely, I think, recreated the Valhall, literally a hole. I'm standing in a hole with shields displayed there. We are looking at literally the afterlife that they were writing about, right? And that is where this whole idea came from, in the first place. So we are facilitating a literal afterlife here for these objects. So yeah, better treat it like such.
Wonderful. Let's wrap this up. And we can let people ask you some
Yeah, for sure. I can
questions
talk about
after.
this for hours. So
I think we've done about an hour and a half.
that's great.
So Ruben, thank you very much. If people do want to hear us talk a little bit more about this and hear the patrons' sort of perspective and questions, just pop over to our Patreon. It's patreon.com/NordicMythologyPodcast. And you get the Q&A that we do every week. So there's a whole back catalogue now. And often, like Bob just did then, he made a very good point. The
Yeah,
people who watch do have some really good questions, a lot of stuff that maybe I missed or overlooked. So it is just an extension of the episode. So if there is an episode you listen to and you quite like and would like to hear a little bit more on those Q&As, are that kind of extension, and we get some really good topics covered that
cool.
I often think, fuck me, I wish that was in the main show. And I sometimes wonder, like, is there a way that we can like squeeze it in there? Because there are some really good questions. So yeah, just
Well,
pop over
then,
to there and check that out. Ruben, sorry.
yeah, I was gonna say, like, this is again, many guests say this. I can talk about this for hours, but I mean, if there's any like a detectorist or whatever, and another archaeologist or somebody who works at a museum, I would love to elaborate more on this stuff that I cannot maybe answer in this Q&A, but
Yeah, like I
sure.
said, there's a detectorist that I know of, and I'll send you his page and see what you think. I would love to maybe get the both of you on, and
Yeah, I would
we could
love
just
that.
talk about that as a topic, because he, like I say, he seems very respectful in what he does. I've had some brief conversations, and I've even asked, said, look, I'd love to come out with you and just see what this all is about. And I did question him about like the items, and he did kind of give me a nice response. But I'd love to get on and have that discussion, because I think it is
Yeah,
a
and also people
fascinating one.
like Lajek Gardella, who you had on. I know he's also, not only is he connected to a museum, but he's also an archaeologist and very much thinking about these topics. And I know Lejeune a little bit, but yeah, let's continue.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, so we'll wrap up the main show. Do you want to shout out where people can find you and
Yeah,
follow you,
so
see your work?
I spend way too much time on Instagram. Like that is, I live there basically, more than I should probably, but my photography page is at Vodans. That is Woedans, old spelling of Woden in Dutch. So that is my main page. I have a museum page at Museum Perspective, also on Instagram and on Facebook. That is where I solely post museum photography. That sometimes I both posted both pages, but Vodans is my main page, and yeah, so that's where you can find me. I always love to chat with people. There's a lot of interesting stuff on Instagram
Yeah, absolutely.
and people.
Yeah, so if you want to follow me, it's Daniel underscore Farrand one, obviously the business Horns of Odin, or just the podcast on any of the platforms, it's just at Nordic Mythology Podcast. And also don't forget YouTube, where you can watch the episodes and those little instances where guests hold things up. There are always guests who are showing things, bringing slideshows like Terry Gunnell did. So it does add another perspective, and we're really trying to push that YouTube side of things. So if you do go on there, please hit the subscribe button. But yeah, let's jump in and do the Q&A.